Shalom, Hadavarniks. Welcome to Hadavar Messianic Ministries and our School of Biblical and Jewish Studies. We're studying the prophet Ezekiel. We're in the 2022 edition. We're filming the 2022 edition. And we're in session 34. Session 34 begins in chapter 37 and verse 15. So let's go ahead and review where we were last session. Now, last session, we were in the kingdom. Chapter 36, verses 28 to 38, a little short glimpse of the kingdom. And then we moved into the modern era in chapter 37, verses 1 through 8, the era that we live in now, the church age. And Ezekiel was taken to the valley where he'd seen the vision of God before. And now the valley was filled with dry bones, massive bones all over the valley. And then God told him to prophesy to the bones. So he prophesied, and the bones, with a rattling and a shaking and a kind of a little of an earthquake, all came together from all over the valley and formed skeletons. And then Ezekiel was to prophesy again, and this time skin covered the bones, but there was no breath in them. And you can see here the artist is portraying the skin covering the bones and the organs covering the bones. But there was no breath in the bodies. They were just corpses lying all over the valley. And the point of this is that God would restore Israel using a process. It would not happen instantaneously, and he would use people. And so this is illustrated through the bones coming together and the flesh then coming upon them. And using Ezekiel. See, God didn't need to use Ezekiel, but he wanted to include Ezekiel in this process. And so he told him to prophesy. Again, he didn't need Ezekiel to say those words. God could have just done it. But Ezekiel was part of the process. And that's the point he's making. And the modern state of Israel did come into being through a process. The process is the modern Zionist movement. Starting in 1939. And he used people. One of the key people that God used was Theodor Herzl. There were many others used, but Theodor Herzl is probably the most prominent. So he used process and he used people, Jewish people. He also used Gentile people, such as Lord Arthur Balfour and the very famous Balfour Declaration. He used governments. The World War I was won victoriously by the British and their allies, and then the British were given the mandate over what's called Palestine. And so governments were used. And unfortunately, World War II was also used, and the Holocaust. This had a big impact upon the state of Israel, just as World War I did. And we read in Paul Johnson's book, A History of the Jews, Paul writes, "The First World War made the Zionist state possible. The Second World War made it essential. The Holocaust and the New Zion were organically connected. The murder of 6 million Jews was a prime causative factor in the creation of the state of Israel." Well, then we moved on from our modern era, and we entered the tribulation period in verses 9 through 14. Again, Ezekiel was to prophesy, and he's prophesying over the corpses. You see, the vast army there is not alive. It's just corpses lying on the ground. But he prophesied, and what happened? Breath came into them. The spirit of life came into them, and they stood up an exceedingly great army. So what are the points of the vision? The first point, Israel is to be regathered in a state of unbelief. Secondly, eventually Israel will come to recognize her God. And the third point, Israel would be regenerated. She would come to life. She would come to life. While before she was just dead in the diaspora, then she would come to life. And then the fourth point, she will have a final restoration. And between the first and second point, between A and B, will come the great tribulation. It'll come after the regathering and unbelief, but before Israel recognizes her God. Well, this brings us to the new material. And now we come to chapter 37, verses 15 through 28. and the sign of the two sticks. The sign is as verses 15 through 17. We begin with the word of the Lord. We move here into the kingdom period as we move into verse 15. And the new revelation begins. So here's our new revelation. The word of the Lord came again to me, saying. Now, this is, of course, a very common formula for new revelation. And the revelation is about the two sticks in verse 16. And you, son of man, take for yourself one stick and write on it for Judah and for the sons of Israel, his companions. Then take another stick and write on it for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and all the house of Israel, his companions. So the stick for Judah would be a reference to the southern kingdom. And so the companions of Judah, the southern kingdom, would be Benjamin and Simeon. Now, here is Judah, which dominates the southern kingdom. And tucked into its northern border is the little tribe of Benjamin. And found within Judah is the tribe of Simeon. They were settled within Judah and became absorbed into Judah. So that's Judah and his companions, which is the southern kingdom. Then Ezekiel is to take another stick, and he's to write upon it for Joseph. And, of course, Joseph was the father of Ephraim and Manasseh. This would be the stick for Ephraim. Ephraim was the most prominent son. So it's a stick for Ephraim and for all the house of Israel and his companions. Well, that would be the other nine tribes. So Joseph and his companions, or Ephraim and his companions, would be the northern kingdom here, all the tribes of the northern kingdom. And then the two sticks are joined together in verse 17. Then join them for yourself, one to another, into one stick, that they may become one in your hand. Now, a very key word is used here. It's the word one, the word echad in the Hebrew. The word echad is used four times. You know, join them for yourself, echad, one to echad, one to another, into echad, one stick, that they may become one, echadim, a plural, in your hand. So the word echad being used four times in this verse emphasizes that this word can very legitimately mean compound unity. Here we have one stick made up of two parts, a compound unity. And this becomes really important when we look at Deuteronomy 6:4. In Deuteronomy 6:4 we read, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one, the Lord is echad." And so that can be very legitimately understood to mean compound unity. And of course, that's what the revelation of the Brit HaDashah brings to us, that God is a compound unity of three. He's triune, Father, Son, and Spirit. Very important little word. All right, now we come to the explanation of this sign that God is going to give through Ezekiel. And the explanation comes when the people make an inquiry of Ezekiel. Verse 18. When the sons of your people speak to you, saying, "Will you not declare to us what you mean by these?" So what? That was the purpose of the sign. That's the purpose of the symbolic act, to create curiosity, excite curiosity. And this also shows us that Ezekiel is now being taken quite seriously. Whatever he does or says something, the people pay attention. Well, his answer comes in verse 19. "Say to them, thus says the Lord God, behold, I will take the stick of Joseph, which is in the hand of Ephraim, and the tribes of Israel, his companions, and I will put them with it, with the stick of Judah, and make them one stick, and they will be one in my hand." So he's going to take the two sticks, the one of Joseph, Ephraim, and the one of Judah, and they're going to be one in God's hand. Now, this is God's hand because God is speaking here. And the point is that Judah and Israel will become one nation again by the power of God. He'll bring them together and he'll hold them together. And now Ezekiel receives his personal instruction in verse 20. "The sticks on which you write will be in your hand before their eyes." So he's to hang on to these two sticks in the presence of the people as he explains the meaning of this symbolic act. And the two sticks actually remain two sticks. So there's no miracle involved here. The end of one stick is held against the end of the other stick, and the hand, Ezekiel's hand, covers the joint, so they appear as one. So here is the illustration. This is the symbol. We have the stick for Ephraim, mentioned here, the stick for Yehudah, mentioned there, and then the butts of each stick are Ezekiel's hands, the one stick on the left, the other stick on the right, and they butt up against each other. But the seam is disguised under Ezekiel's hand. And so the two sticks appear as one. That is the illustration of the two tribes, the two nations, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, becoming one. So now God explains the application in verse 21. Say to them, thus says the Lord God, behold, I will take the sons of Israel from among the nations where they have gone, and I will gather them from every side and bring them into their own land. So the Jewish people will be regathered. They'll be regathered from the nations. That means they'll be regathered worldwide. To where? To their own land. Very strong emphasis here that the land belongs to the Jewish people, their own land. And we will be unified in verse 22. And I will make them one nation in the land on the mountains of Israel, and one king will be king for all of them, and they will no longer be two nations and no longer be divided into two kingdoms. So we're going to be brought together as one nation. The place is upon the mountains of Israel. The leadership is the fact that one king will be over them all, and that king will be David. He'll be king over Israel, as we'll see in chapter 37, verse 24. And there's also one God involved here, and this is Yeshua, who's king over the whole world, Zechariah 14:9. And the Lord will be king over all the earth. In that day, the Lord will be the only one, and his name, the only one. So the nature of this reunification is that it is indivisible. So it's going to be upon the mountains of Israel, the place. They'll have a king, that's the leadership, and the nature indivisible. Never to be divided into two kingdoms anymore, a united people, an indivisible people. But the Jewish people have to be cleansed before all this happens, and that's described in verse 23. They will no longer defile themselves with their idols or with their detestable things or with any of their transgressions. But I will deliver them from all their dwelling places in which they have sinned and will cleanse them, and they will be my people and I will be their God. So no more defilements. We take up the negative side of the promise. They won't worship idols anymore. We won't worship idols anymore. No more idolatry. We'll have nothing to do with detestable things. Detestable things, the word means anything that brings on ritual uncleanliness. So nor will there be detestable things, nor will there be transgressions. Transgression means to violate a commandment. So the Jewish people will not violate the commandments of millennial law. So that's the negative part. No more idolatry, no more ritual uncleanliness, no more transgression, no more violation of commandments. Then we come to the positive side, the positive aspect of the promise, and I will cleanse them, and the result, they will be my people, and I will be their God. So this is another reference to the national regeneration of Israel in faith. Salvation is by grace through faith, plus nothing. And so Israel will be regenerated in faith by placing their faith in Yeshua. Now there will also be a restoration of the Davidic throne when the nation is restored. And so the position of David is brought out in verse 24. My servant David will be king over them, and they will all have one shepherd. So king, that is David's office. He's the governor. But he's also described as a shepherd, and that is his function. He is to guide Israel and to feed Israel. That's the job of a shepherd. Now, some commentators don't feel that they want to take this part of the verse literally. They don't feel you should take this part of the verse literally. And so to them, The word David there, my servant David, really means Jesus, my servant Yeshua, or my servant the Messiah. But I see no reason why David cannot be a resurrected King David, as in Ezekiel 34, verses 23 and 24. So I think this is the resurrected King David to be king over Israel. Israel will also be obedient at this time, in verse 24, and they will walk in my ordinances and keep my statutes and observe them. So under David's leadership and shepherding, the nation will obey Messianic kingdom law. This won't be obedience to Mosaic law. The Mosaic law is no longer our word of life, our rule of life, but the Messianic kingdom law will be our rule of life. And it's emphasized again that Israel will possess the land in verse 25, and they will live on the land that I gave to Jacob my servant, in which their fathers lived, and they will live on it, they and their sons' sons forever. So we will finally occupy and enjoy all of the promised land. And this will include the faithful remnant from every era of Jewish history, along with their dependents. And the word, the final word, is the word forever. This rendering is a little strong because the word literally means unto an age. So it would be better to view this as throughout the kingdom age. Throughout the kingdom age, Israel will enjoy the promised land for the 1,000-year kingdom. And of course, after the 1,000 years, there'll be a brand new heavens and a new earth as well. And so that promise will be fulfilled completely. Now, the position of David is emphasized at the second part of verse 25. And David, my servant, will be their prince forever. Now, this seems a little bit contradictory to the preceding verses, but the difference lies in the viewpoint of the person making the comment. From the viewpoint of Messiah, David is a prince. David is under King Messiah. He's under the worldwide king as the prince over Israel. And again, the statement ends with the word forever, but again, it's a little too strong a rendering. The word is leolam, for an age. And so this is a promise that will be fulfilled throughout the age of the Messianic kingdom. He will be king over Israel during the Messianic kingdom. Now, let's go back to that government chart, the government in the Messianic kingdom. We see that Yeshua is King Messiah. And David is given the title of king, and he's given the title of prince. And that's from Yeshua's point of view, because as Messiah, as king over the world, David is underneath the authority of King Messiah, but he's over the nation of Israel. So he's a prince under King Messiah. But from Israel's point of view, he is the king because they are under Israel. So all these titles basically refer to the point of view of the person who is speaking, king or prince. All right, now we come to verse 26, and we come to the new covenant. And this new covenant is going to be the basis of the new temple, as we'll see in just a little bit. So verse 26, I will make a covenant of peace with them. It will be an everlasting covenant with them. So this is the new covenant of Jeremiah 31, 31 and following. Now it'll be an everlasting covenant, a berit olam. Now here, olam is best understood as everlasting. Otherwise, salvation would not be eternal. Now, because the essence of the new covenant is individual salvation. And this is the attributive use of the word. It's like it's used with God. God is, one of the names of God is El Olam. El Olam. This is a Brit Olam. So God is everlasting, and so this can very reasonably and accurately be translated as an everlasting covenant. Now, the provisions of this new covenant are in the second part of verse 26. And I will place them and multiply them and will set my sanctuary in their midst forever. So I'll place them in their land and I'll multiply them, an increase in population. This is needed after the decimation of the tribulation Holocaust. Remember, 66% of the Jewish people worldwide will be killed during the tribulation Holocaust. So we need to be multiplied. And he says, I will set my sanctuary in the midst of them forever. My sanctuary is the millennial temple. He calls it my holy place. And so the emphasis is on the holiness of the building. And there again, le'olam is the word that should be translated probably better for an age, not forever, but for the 1,000 years of the Messianic kingdom. And then when there's a new heavens and the new earth, we see that there won't even be a temple, but God will dwell. The whole earth will be the temple there, actually. And so let's take a look at a couple of drawings of the millennial temple. Here is a possible floor plan for the millennial temple. This is the way one artist renders the material in the book of Ezekiel, and we'll see this again as we get to chapters 40 through 48. And here is another artist rendering of the millennial temple. It's possible that it may look like this as well. But anyway, this will be God's sanctuary, God's dwelling place on earth in the midst of Israel for the Messianic kingdom. Now, the relationship between God and Israel is brought out in verse 27. My dwelling place also will be with them, and I will be their God, and they will be my people. So again, my tabernacle, my presence, my dwelling place, as in the NASB, will be with them. And the emphasis is on the new temple as the dwelling place of the Shekinah glory, the Shekinah. The word there translated over them, or here, how does the NASB translate it? With them. That's not the best translation. The Hebrew word is Aleichem, which means over them. So the Shekinah glory will be over them. That's a better rendering than with them, because the Shekinah glory will be a canopy at that time. That'll be one of the manifestations of the Shekinah glory as a canopy. And that's brought out in Isaiah 4, 5, and 6. Then the Lord will create over the whole area of Mount Zion, that's millennial Mount Zion, and over her assemblies a cloud by day, the Shekinah glory cloud, even smoke and a brightness of a flaming fire by night. Remember the Shekinah glory when we were led out of Egypt was a cloud by day, looked like a cloud by day, a glowing cloud by day, and a flaming fire at night. Well, that's the same phenomena that's happening here. For over all the glory will be a canopy. There will be a shelter to give shade from the heat by day and a refuge and protection from the storm and the rain. So there'll be weather in the kingdom. And here is an artist's illustration of the Shekinah glory as a canopy over millennial Mount Zion. I think that's a great little picture there of the protection and glory of God over millennial Mount Zion and over Jerusalem, over the temple. It'll be quite a sight for everybody to see. Now, the results for Israel, we read that I will be their God, they shall be my people. And again, this is an emphasis on the nation's regenerate, saved, born-again state. That's the result for Israel. There will also be a result for the Gentiles in verse 28. And the nations will know that I am the Lord who sanctifies Israel when my sanctuary is in their midst forever. So the nations will know that it is the Lord that sanctifies Israel. Israel's God is the only true God. And that the Jewish people are indeed the chosen people. Not the superior people, but the chosen people. Chosen to do a job. And the time when this happens, when my sanctuary shall be in the midst of them forever. And of course my sanctuary again is the rendering of my holy place. And this will be for an age. The word forever there is le'olam again. For the 1,000 years of the Messianic kingdom. And again, this will all be detailed as we get to chapters 40 through 48. So stick with me here because we've got some great stuff ahead of us to look at. All right. Now it's time to move into chapter 38. Now before I move into chapter 38, I want to preface the study with some remarks by Dr. Thomas Ice in his paper, Ezekiel 38, 39, Part 1. And if you'd like to read this entire paper, then you can find it at the website address there underneath his name. So anyway, let me read a few excerpts from the beginning of this paper. He states, The battle of Gog and Magog in Ezekiel 38 and 39 is one of the most debated items in the area of biblical prophecy. Commentator Ralph Alexander said, one of the perennial enigmas of biblical prophecy has been the Gog and Magog event described in Ezekiel 38 and 39. Almost every aspect of this ancient prophecy has been disputed, including whether it was fulfilled in the past or is still a future prophecy. Who are the people involved, and do they relate to modern nations? How do we understand the weapons that are described? If a future event, when does it take place on the prophetic timeline? Awfully good questions there. He continues, the emerging evangelical scholarly, in quotes, scholarly view is that prophecy should not be taken literally, as has been done by dispensationalists. Yes, I take prophecy literal as often as I can. And they say that we know this primarily because the prophetic portions of the Bible are apocalyptic, which are not intended to be taken literally. Now, here is the crux of the whole matter. They may not be able to tell you what these sections of Scripture actually mean. They may not be able to know what it means, but one thing they know for sure, prophecy should not be interpreted literally. That is according to the historical grammatical approach. Well, we don't agree with that, with this non-literal approach. Finally, he finishes up, and prophecy is primarily about ideas and principles, not future historical events. Well, I've been interpreting Ezekiel through the historical grammatical approach as literally as possible as a dispensationalist, and yes, it is about future historical events, not just about ideas and principles. So we totally disagree with this viewpoint that you may run into in other classes other than my own. The problem with this viewpoint is it just strips God of all his majesty, all his glory, and all his power. It just negates everything, the glory we see in Scripture. A very poor position that's emerging among commentators. So be alert for it. It's not the position that we take here at Hadavar Messianic Ministries. All right, before we get into Ezekiel proper, let's review Ezekiel's time frames. Remember, he goes into the distant past. He deals with his own time, the Babylonian exile, the near future, the first coming of Yeshua, the tribulation period, the second coming of Yeshua, and the kingdom. And we had to add in another time frame, the church age. That occurs after the first coming, but before the tribulation period. And that's where chapter 38:1 through 39:16 falls, in what we call the modern era. Today, we should look for these events to happen today, sometime in our time frame. All right, and the events are the invasion by Gog and Magog. So we begin with our standard revelation transition. And the word of the Lord came to me saying, the new revelation is going to be about the leadership of a military confederacy. Son of man, this is verse 2. Son of man, set your face toward Gog in the land of Magog, the prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal, and prophesy against him. So Ezekiel is told to set your face toward, prophesy in opposition to, prophesy against who? Against Gog. Now, this is not a proper name. This is a title for the ruler of Magog. It's a shortened form of Magog. Like, it's a title like Pharaoh or Caesar or the Shah of Iran, anything like that. Now, this verse has generated all kinds of ridiculous exegesis. And the one that amazed me occurred when President George Bush of the United States went to visit Israel during his time as the presidency. And some Orthodox rabbis came up with the Megillat Bush, the Bush Scroll. And here's just part of that Bush Scroll. They published it. The important area that I want you to look at is right here. Let's make it a little bigger. Yes, I know it's pretty hard to read, even at this size, so let's make it very readable. There we read, "Esteemed Mr. George W. Bush, the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal, leader of the West." So these rabbis saw this verse as being fulfilled in President George Bush of the United States of America. Now, how in the world did they come to such a silly conclusion as that? Well, I'll show you what they did. They took President George W. Bush's name. They pulled his first name out. They capitalized all the letters in his first name, and then they enlarged every other letter, and guess what popped out? Gog! There, hidden in George W. Bush's name is the fact that he is Gog. He is the leader of the West. He is the leader of this military coalition. Very, very crazy exegesis indeed. You won't get that from Hadavar Messianic Ministries. All right. So this Gog is from the land of Magog. That's where he's from. He's a Magog guy. And he's also a son of Japhet. And this is in Genesis 10:2. The sons of Japhet were Gomer and Magog and Madai and Yavan and Tubal and Meshech and Tiras. So he and his descendants were located between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea, which today is southern Russia. Now here is the Table of Nations, and there is Gog in between, or I should say the land of Magog, in between the Caspian Sea and the Black Sea, and that's all southern Russia. Now if we go to a modern map of some of the modern countries, there we have Magog in between the Black and Caspian Sea, but other commentators think that it may be in Turkey. It may be in Turkey. And finally, as we go to a different map, some commentators even feel that Magog immigrated up into Afghanistan, up into this area. So there's a lot of controversy over the locations of these groups. Now, so please understand that I will be holding my position with an open hand. I'm not going to definitively say that this is the absolutely correct position, but I think it's the best position to hold given the information we know to date. So that's the location of Magog. Now, he's the prince of. Gog also rules over three other territories. The first one mentioned is Rosh. Now, some versions translate this word as leader or head or something like that, but it's better to leave it as a proper noun because it speaks of northern Russia. In fact, it's the root of the word Russia. So Rosh is the root of the word Russia. You see it on the map there. And again, to be perfectly fair, other commentators, other map makers see no connection between the word Rosh and Russia. All right, the second territory he rules Rosh, but he also rules Meshech. And Meshech is a son of Japhet, again in Genesis 10:2. The sons of Japhet were Gomer and Magog and Madai and Yavan and Tubal and Meshech and Tiras. Now, here's our Table of Nations again. And Meshech is thought to be here in Asia Minor. We go to our modern map, and modern commentators aren't sure where Meshech is to be located, northern Turkey, southern Turkey, or eastern Turkey. So like I said, there's a lot of controversy over the locations and the meanings of the word. Well, this word Meshech gave rise to the name Moscow. So if we go north from Meshech, we go directly north, and guess what? We run smack dab into the town of Moskva, or Moscow. And again, some other commentators and map makers see no connection between the words. So it's fair just to mention that this is a controversial position. Every position is controversial here in these chapters. All right, he's also the ruler over Tubal. Tubal is also a son of Japhet. The sons of Yafet were Gomer and Magog and Madai and Yavan and Tubal and Meshach and Tiras. Again, back to our table of nations, and Tubal is thought to be in southern Asia Minor. We go to our modern map makers, and they see Tubal in southern Turkey or in the middle of Turkey, mid-Turkey. Central Turkey would probably be a better way to put it. But this name, Tubal, is a very interesting name because it gave rise to the name Tobolsk in Syria, in Siberia. Okay, now here is a map of the area, and if you go north from Tubal, directly north, you come to the city of Tobolsk in Siberia. Now here's a map of Russia. This is the Ural Mountains. The Ural Mountains divides Russia into Western Russia, or European Russia, and then Eastern Russia, or Siberia. Siberia is the eastern side of Russia. So here's another map with the red line indicating the Ural Mountains. And then you see in Siberia that red state, Tyumen Oblast. It's a state or the equivalent to some kind of a political designation there in Russia, Tyumen Oblast. So let's go into a close-up of Tyumen Oblast. And there in Tyumen Oblast is the town of Tobolsk, the Tubal of Ezekiel chapter 38, verse 2. Now let's take some, here's the picture of Tobolsk in 1913, pretty little town on the river there, and here's a more modern, a more modern view of Tobolsk. This is the Tobolsk Kremlin. The word Kremlin there means castle. Of course, this is taken in the winter, a little bit different weather. But this is was the capital of Siberia. This was the capital of Siberia. And this is where the last Tsarist family was assassinated. So it's a famous place. It's also the birthplace of Dr. Fruchtenbaum, Dr. Arnold G. Fruchtenbaum. Now, other commentators, again, see no connection between Tobol and Tobolsk. Tubal and Tobolsk. I'm not pronouncing that very well, am I? Tobolsk. There we go. Tubal and Tobolsk. All right. Now, the four territorial names, the four territories that we looked at, are today all part of the former Soviet Union, which is now called the Commonwealth of Independent States. And this covers both northern and southern parts of European Russia and Siberia and the Asian part of Russia. So here are the associations that we have at this point with Russia. Magog is southern Russia, a territory. Rosh is northern Russia, a territory. Meshech is Moscow, Russia, a city. And Tubal is Tobolsk in Russia, again, another city. So those are the associations we have so far. But we also have rabbinic traditions associated with Russia. And in rabbinic traditions, we read that Gog and Magog are hostile armies that are coming against Israel before the invasion, before the coming, excuse me, of Messiah ben David. Gog and Magog are connected with the war in which Messiah ben Yosef is killed. Now, you see, hear me just mention two messiahs, the coming of Mashiach ben David and a war in which Mashiach ben Yosef is killed. Well, Bob, what's going on here? What's this stuff about two messiahs? Well, we've just walked into the two messiah theory of the rabbis. So I need to make sure I review with you the two messiah theory so you'll understand it better. This is the modern rabbinic position today. Now, if you want to study it in more detail, I would suggest that you buy the book, The Messiah Text by Raphael Patai. He was an Israeli scholar, and he goes into this in good detail. So, what is the two messiah theory? Well, the problem is, the paradox of the rabbis is that they could never reconcile a suffering and dying messiah with a reigning messiah. You know, this guy suffers and dies. How can he reign? What's going on here? So their conclusion is that the scriptures talked about two messianic persons, two messiahs. A suffering messiah, totally independent from a triumphant messiah. The suffering messiah they called Mashiach ben Yosef, or sometimes Mashiach ben Ephraim, and then Messiah son of David, sometimes called Messiah, son of Judah. So we have Mashiach ben Yosef, the suffering Messiah, and Mashiach ben David, the triumphant Messiah. All right, so let's take a look at the suffering Messiah side of the coin. Now, this is a two-sided coin. So the suffering Messiah is Mashiach ben Yosef. He comes and he's humiliated. He suffers physical harm. He dies a violent substitutionary death. He dies in the wars of Gog and Magog. And Isaiah 52:53 would support this position of a suffering Messiah. Now, let's go to the other side of the coin. Before we do, remember now, our emphasis here is that he dies in the wars of Gog and Magog. That's why he's brought in here. All right, let's go to the triumphant Messiah side of the coin, and we come to Mashiach ben David. Now, Mashiach ben David comes, and he's a conquering king, and he defeats Israel's enemies, and he institutes the Messianic kingdom, and he resurrects the suffering Messiah. He resurrects Messiah ben Yosef. And Genesis 49, 9 and 10 support the triumphant Messiah position. So here is the two Messiah theory of the rabbis today. Now, if you're witnessing to your Jewish friend and you start talking about the suffering Messiah, your Jewish friend could very well say to you, "Hey, wait a second, I've never heard about this. All I know is that the Messiah is a conquering king. So I don't know what you're talking about. I'm going to go to the rabbi and talk about this, see what he says." So he goes to the rabbi, he goes to the anti-missionary. What is the rabbi going to do? He's not going to show him the material on the suffering Messiah. He's going to take the Messianic coin, which has two sides, and he's going to flop it on the table with the triumphant side reigning up, the reigning Messiah side facing up. Okay, this is the Messiah, and he's going to say to your friend, "The servant is not Jesus. The suffering servant is not Jesus. The suffering servant is the nation Israel. It has nothing to do with Jesus." Or he might say, "Jesus is not the Messiah because he didn't fulfill the prophecies." And he's going to point to the reigning Messiah, the triumphant Messiah prophecies. Or he may quote the Rabbinical Council of America and their resolution of June 1996. The RCA represents about 1,000 centrist Orthodox rabbis. Here's what they said. "There is not, and never has been, a place in Judaism for the belief that Mashiach ben David, Messiah son of David, will begin his messianic mission only to experience death, burial, and resurrection before completing it." In other words, there's no such thing as a suffering Messiah. So don't listen to your Christian friend. He's just puffing smoke. Well, what do you have to do in the face of a challenge like this? Well, what you have to do is walk over to that Messianic coin that's flat now on the desk with the reigning side of the Messiah on top, so you can't see the suffering side, and you're going to have to pick up that coin and turn it over. So the suffering Messiah side of the coin is visible, and then begin to show how Yeshua is the suffering Messiah. Yeshua is the suffering Messiah. So the rabbis had a paradox, the two Messiah theory. That's how they solved it, two Messiahs. But the New Testament has a solution to this paradox as well. And the New Testament, the Brit HaDashah's solution, is much more elegant and much simpler. Basically, and it's not two Messiahs coming, it's two advents of Messiah. That's the Brit HaDashah's position. There are two advents of the Messiah. So let's look on the suffering Messiah side of the coin first. It's Yeshua of Nazareth. The suffering Messiah is Yeshua of Nazareth. At his first coming, he suffers humiliation, physical harm, a violent substitutionary death. He dies on the cross. He doesn't die in the war of Gog and Magog. And Isaiah 52:53 support this. And now we flip over the coin and we look at the triumphant Messiah side of the coin. Again, Yeshua of Nazareth at the second coming. He's a conquering king. He defeats Israel's enemies. He institutes the Messianic kingdom. He resurrects all those trusting in him, not just the Messiah ben Yosef. No, he resurrects everybody who's died trusting in him. And Genesis 49, 9 and 10 support this position. So, two advents of Messiah is what you want to present to your Jewish friend. Two advents of Messiah. All right. Let's move over to the Art Scroll Tanakh series. This is a rabbinic commentary on Ezekiel. And take a look at some of the traditions, the links to Russia that are found in rabbinic literature. So in the Art Scroll Tanakh commentary, you'll find this. You'll find this comment. The Gaonim had a tradition that these countries were indeed located in Russia. The Gaonim is a rabbinic school. And then you'll also read in the Art Scroll commentary, oral tradition passed down from the Vilna Gaon, and here's what he passed down. When the Russian Navy passes through the Bosphorus, that is, on the way to the Dardanelles, it will be time to put on Sabbath clothes, and this is in anticipation of the coming of the Messiah. So the rabbis understood the passage in Ezekiel to refer to Russia. Now here is a modern map, and the Bosphorus is this little strait that allows you to enter the Black Sea, a little entrance into the Black Sea, the Bosphorus. Here's a close-up. Here is the Bosphorus right here, out of the Black Sea into the Sea of Marmara. And this is an aerial view of the Bosphorus, that little cleft in the rock that allows you to get into the Black Sea. Now, here is the Dardanelles that were mentioned. The Dardanelles are on the other side of the Sea of Marmara, and they lead out into the Aegean Sea. And here's a close-up of the Dardanelles. So you go through the Bosphorus for the Sea of Marmara, then you go through the Dardanelles, and you're in the Aegean Sea, and here is a satellite picture of the Dardanelles. So when that happens, get ready for the coming of the Messiah, when you see Russia, the Russian Navy, heading for the Aegean Sea. So here's our previous associations for them. Now we have to add another association. So this association is rabbinic tradition from the Gaonim that makes this refer to the Russian Navy. So we have five associations in the Jewish mind with this speaking of Russia. Now as we come to verses 3 and 4, we come to God's declaration of divine opposition to Gog. Verse 3. And say, thus says the Lord God, behold, I am against you, O Gog, prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal. So God singles out this world leader for judgment. He's being singled out for judgment. And the preparation for the invasion is described in verse 4. And I will turn you about and put hooks in your jaws, and I will bring you out, and all your army, horses and horsemen, all of them splendidly attired, a great company with buckler and shield, all of them wielding swords. So God says, I will turn you about, Gog. So Gog will be diverted away from a planned attack in another direction. And instead, he's going to come south against Israel. God says, I will put hooks in your jaws. And this is so Gog can do nothing else. You know, Gog is like Pharaoh Hophra back in chapter 29, verse 4. He's a monster to be dragged to his doom. And then thirdly, God says, I will bring you forth. God is bringing this invasion about. So this is all speaking of God's sovereignty. He is going to do this. And so Gog comes out with his army, all of his army. He's accompanied with all of his army. Now here, God is speaking in terms Ezekiel can understand. All of this is a description of a well-equipped military force. God is not speaking in 21st century terms. He does not intend to. He's speaking to Ezekiel so that Ezekiel and his contemporaries and those following him can understand what's going on. Because this will be these description of a well-equipped army is valid clear up to World War I. In World War I, horsemen were still being used, mules and horsemen and etc. The mechanized nature of modern warfare didn't really come into play until World War I. So that's just a recent innovation. a recent invention, I guess is the word I'm saying. But everyone prior to World War I would understand these terms as a well-equipped military force. So now the Allies are described in verses 5 and 6. Persia, Ethiopia, and Put, with all of them with shield and helmet, Gomer, with all its troops, Bet-Togarma, from the remote parts of the earth, with all his troops, many peoples with you. So the first ally mentioned is Persia. Now, Persia was also a son of Japheth from Madai. This is Genesis 10:2 and 1 Chronicles 1:4. But on our map today, Persia would be modern Iran. Modern Iran is Persia today. The second ally mentioned is Cush. He was a son of Ham in Genesis 10:6. And this is thought to be biblical Ethiopia, or the Sudan, what we would call the Sudan today. Then we come to Put, who's a son of Ham in Genesis 10:6. And we're not sure exactly where Put should be located. Some think Put should be located in Somalia or Somaliland. Others think Put is Libya, modern Libya. They're described, though, all with shield and helmet. So all three nations are prepared for war. They're ready to join this northern coalition. Then we come to Gomer, a son of Japheth in Genesis 10:2. Now, the Jewish commentary, Bereshit Rabbah 37:1, spells Gomer as Germania. And in the Talmud, Gomer is also mentioned as this called Germania. What does that sound like to you? Well, you're right. Germany. Germany is Germania in Hebrew. So it's thought that Gomer may be Germany. It's also thought that Gomer might be the Ukraine. So we're not sure exactly where Gomer is. But there's numerous men in his army. Then we come to the house of Togarma, a grandson of Japheth through Gomer, Genesis 10:3. Togarma is located in Armenia here, and possibly southern Turkey. And the evaluation, all his hordes. There's numerous men in his army. And his location is the uttermost parts of the north. Now, in this verse, the phrase specifically refers to Togarma, to the north of Israel. In chapter 38, verse 15, and in chapter 39, verse 2, it refers to the entire invading army. And from Israel, Russia is the uttermost parts of the north is Russia. You just go north from Israel, and what do you run into? You run into Russia from there all the way to the North Pole. And here is another map. Here we have Israel to the south, directly north of Israel is, guess what? Moskva. And if you keep on going north, you go all the way up to the Arctic Circle, the North Pole. Russia is to the uttermost parts of the north from Israel, from Jerusalem. Well, let me kind of summarize this up a little bit. Apparently, the armies will gather in Russia. Now, we don't know where in Russia. Will they gather in southern Russia? Who knows? But apparently, they're going to attack somewhere else. It looks like they're going on the offensive somewhere else. And then suddenly, by surprise, move south against Israel. Will they go through Syria? Will they go through Persia? Through Iran? Who knows? But they've got to move south and invade Israel. And then the description continues, even many peoples with you. This statement can be understood in two ways. It may refer to the numbers of people already mentioned, the numerous military hordes that have gathered, that have already been mentioned. Or it may refer to other nations, even more allies, other coalition members that have not been mentioned because they're minor members of the coalition. But there are 6 Japhethite nations mentioned and 2 Hamitic nations mentioned, but no Semitic nations mentioned. Not a single Arab state appears to be part of this invasion. And you may say, wait a second, Bob, what about Libya? Well, Libya is Berber. Libya is mostly Berber peoples. And returning to the Art School commentary again, we read, Yerushalami Megillah 3:9 renders Magog as the Goths, a group of nomadic tribes who destroyed the Scythians and made their homes in Scythian territory. Considering that the Goths were a Germanic people, the identification of Magog's descendants is in accord with Targum Yonatan to Genesis 10:2, which renders Magog as Germania, Germany, Hebrew for Germany. So, now we have a traditional Jewish association of Magog with Germany or the Ukraine, as well as with Russia. So our first 5 associations were with Russia. The next association is Magog with Germany or the Ukraine. So perhaps Russia and the Ukraine and Russia and Germany, or all 3, become unusually close allies. Only time will tell. Only time will tell. All right, let's move on to the place of the invasion. And we start now in verse 7. Be prepared and prepare yourself, you and all your companies that are assembled about you. Be a guard for them. So there's 2 aspects. You be prepared. You be prepared. The you is very emphatic. Prepare yourself, Gog, and all your companies. All those that are assembled with you, all the military forces assembled with you, and you are to be a guard for them. That word means a guard, a protector. In other words, take command. Gog is to take general responsibility for the entire army that's assembled, and he's to be responsible for the well-being of his soldiers. So Gog is the commander-in-chief of this coalition with leadership responsibilities. All right, and the object of the invasion is in verse 8. After many days you will be summoned. In the latter years you will come into the land that is restored from the sword, whose inhabitants have been gathered from many nations to the mountains of Israel, which have been a continual waste. But this people was brought out from the nations, and they are living securely, all of them. All right, the time of this invasion, it's after many days you shall be visited. It's in the latter years, in the last days. It's all eschatological in context. So this is going to occur sometime in the last days, but we don't know exactly when in the last days it will occur until we get to chapter 39, verse 16. So we'll get there soon. The object, you shall come into the land, and a very accurate description follows. It's a land brought forth from the sword. The sword would be the 2,000 years of persecution, climaxing with the Holocaust of World War II. It's a land that's gathered out of many peoples. This refers to the current worldwide dispersion of Jewish people among 90 nations. It will come upon the mountains of Israel, which have been a continual waste. Well, the mountains of Israel are in the West Bank today. This is the Judean Hills, the backbone of Israel. So it's going to come upon the mountains of Israel. It is brought forth out of the peoples. This is a repetition of the thought that this is a worldwide return, and they shall dwell securely, all of them. The word again means confidence. The word means confidence, securely. It means confidence. It does not necessarily mean an absence of strife. So this invasion will occur after the first worldwide regathering in unbelief in preparation for the tribulation. And the prophecy could not have been fulfilled before 1948 because there was no Jewish state before 1948. But exactly when after 1948 it will be fulfilled awaits chapter 39, verse 16. We'll get there. Have patience. So note, at the time of the invasion, Israel will be in possession of the West Bank. And the significance of this lies in the fact that if a Palestinian state is ever established, it will only be temporary. If it ever gets established, it'll be temporary. The West Bank cannot be the state of Palestine. It is the state of Israel. All right. Well, I've come to the end of my time right now. And we'll pick this up again in the next session. We'll pick it up on verse 9 again, which deals with the massiveness of the invasion. And we'll continue to work our way through this invasion of Israel by Gog and Magog. All right, so glad you're willing to be our students. Happy to have you as our students here in Heart of Our Messianic Ministries. We trust that these classes are a joy to your heart encouraging you to be disciples of Jesus the Messiah and lovers of the Jewish people and the state of Israel. So we'll see you next session. Lahitraot. Lahitraot.